I'm Marty Moscoway, and welcome to Radio Times. There is no downtime for reporters covering national politics between the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections, the Mueller investigation, and now impeachment. Robert Costa has had a front row seat to all of this as national reporter for The Washington Post, moderator for PBS's Washington Week, and analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. He got his start in journalism in high school when he wrote for the Bucks County Courier-Times just outside of Philadelphia. I interviewed him on Saturday night for an event for WHYY donors when he talked about what it takes to cover our politics. I was trying to do the math and count the first time that Robert Costa was a guest on Radio Times, but I know it was when he was working at National Review.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking for what we called a conservative guest, someone who could come in and give us the conservative point of view. We probably had booked a liberal guest on the show. So Bob was a guest on Radio Times, and he was so nonpartisan. I was actually quite shocked, and we had a rather uneven interview that day. But I so appreciate the fact that even in 2019, you are able to find that kind of middle point and really resist the opining that we see so much, especially among journalists.
Well, I appreciate that, Marty. It's wonderful to be here at WHYY. I did get my start at National Review, which is a funny story, though, how things that you think are horrible career experiences end up being the best experiences. I went to Pensbury High School, went to Notre Dame, went to Cambridge, and I was at Cambridge getting my master's degree in politics, studying Churchill in 2009. And I'm over there, and my parents saying, this is your thing. I had no money. I could barely even afford to kind of get cool clothes or eat good food. And the British food's already bad enough over there. So I'm sitting there in Cambridge. I'm trying to get a job in journalism. And I have no money to fly over for interviews. So I'm trying to get a job through a phone interview. Couldn't get an interview because no one wanted to hire someone over the phone. So long story short, I see a thing for a fellowship at National Review online. And I say, hey, that looks like an opportunity to report on national politics. So I call up National Review. I said, hey, have you filled this spot? And they said, yeah, we haven't filled it, but what would you want to do here? I said, look, I'm not conservative. Could you have someone who's just a reporter on the conservative movement? And they said, that's a very strange thing. We've never hired someone at National Review who just wants to report. Most people want to write a column. I said, actually, I would appreciate it if I came to National Review as a fellow, as like a glorified intern, if I could never write a column. And because I'm a logical person. I want to have a career. I don't want to be seen my whole career as someone who worked at National Review. Clearly, that's not the case. Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
6 years at the Washington Post, 3 years at PBS, National Review. But let me explain.
You got to start somewhere, though.
That's true. I started at the Bucks County Courier Times.
Yeah.
But covering music. You know, that was the way I got dates. I was limited in my dating skills, but I would try to get dates by getting free concert tickets to be the critic, so I'd make $50 for the Courier, and I'd get 2 tickets from the record label. But I was so bad at passing my driver's test, I'd have to ask the girl out and then have her drive us to the electric factory.
You're giving us a lot in this answer,
so wait,
I have to say.
Let me finish the National Review thing. So I take a job at National Review, and I say to them, look, I want to be super careful. I never want to write a conservative thing here. I'll cover the right like a beat. And I thought I was covering the worst. I thought it was 09, it's the recession. I see all these other, you know, people my age, they're, you know, I'm at the Washington Post or at the New York Times, and I'm at National Review typing away about Sarah Palin's book tour. And I just said, what am I doing with my life? But I got to develop some sources. I got to meet this unknown filmmaker in Pella, Iowa in 2011 who looked like Che Guevara mixed with a homeless man named Steve Bannon. And I would be the only reporter covering this guy Steve Bannon's movies. I got to know a real estate developer who was a birther because I was covering the fringe of the right named Donald Trump. I was the first person Trump ever told about his 2016 ambitions. In 2013, he told me about how he was going to head to Iowa and thinking about 2016. No one paid attention. So long story short, I spent all this time at National Review reporting on the right. Stephen Miller used to send me screeds of emails about Jeff Sessions and what he was up to. I got to know everybody who ended up running the government because I was covering the right. And in 2013, a story of a lifetime lands in my lap. I had the Tea Party network like nobody else. their cell phones, their emails. They shut down the government over Obamacare in 2013, and I break every story on the shutdown, it seems. And the most important story I ever broke was the end of the shutdown. I broke the news, beat the AP, the Times, the Post, at little rinky-dink National Review, that the shutdown was over. And the markets trusted me so much as a reporter in 2013 that my one tweet saying the shutdown is over, and I alone have confirmed it, shot the stock market up hundreds of points. And CNBC wrote a profile story about how one Robert Costa tweet changed the stock market.
Wow.
And so the Washington Post came knocking on my door and said, "Who are you?" And then they said, "We're going to look through every one of your articles at National Review," which they did. This is the Washington Post. They looked through every one of my articles at National Review, and they said, they came back to me, and they said, "You've never once on TV or in print uttered an opinion of any sort." They said, "You want to come be a front page writer for the Washington Post?" Here I am 6 years later.
That's great. But do you, I mean, you clearly have opinions. But
not really. I put them on the shelf. You're very. I get too much of credit for putting my opinions on the shelf. If you're a doctor in here, you have your own opinions about the Phillies, about politics, about your family, about your in-laws. You put them on the shelf and you do your job. I have opinions like anyone American. I'm not ideological. I grew up in Bucks County. I'm a suburban guy from Philly who loves reporting and history. And if you have that love of reporting, I don't think about anything in terms of politics, whether it's good or bad. That's why I was ready for Senator Sanders to win and do well. I have a great relationship with Senator Bernie Sanders. Why? Because I don't assume Democratic Socialists can't win. He loves that about me. He knew I was covering him when no one in the media was taking Sanders seriously. I have the same relationship with President Trump. I have on my desk a sign that says, "Assume nothing." That's my motto as a reporter, because I also saw that Trump could be president of the United States, because I was constantly covering the fringe of the right and the way the Republican Party was evolving. And I have views, but I've never articulated my views because my views are irrelevant. It's my job to provide reporting that illuminates the turbulence in American life.
Well, let me ask you about your first interview with Donald Trump. This is 2013. Mm-hmm. And you talked about trade and immigration. I mean, things that we would recognize today. Does he seem like a different person?
No, he's the same exact person. I mean, he has not changed in the presidency at all. I think back to my first few conversations with him. I'd go up to the 26th floor at Trump Tower, and you really understand when you're with him what drives his politics. Sitting on his desk, he doesn't use a computer, doesn't use email, would be this heavy frame of his father, black and white picture with a little mustache, Fred Trump. And Fred Trump, if you read about him, if you talk to Trump, Mr. Trump about him, President Trump about him, he is someone who always articulated trade as the key issue in American life for him. He saw America as losing. Remember, Fred Trump is real estate in the outer boroughs. They're always thinking about construction and steel. So trade was at the fore of the Trump family's political mind when he's growing up in Jamaica. And they're talking about trade and America losing. And that's the same language Trump used in the 80s, in the late 80s, early 90s. He teased a presidential bid in 87 and in 99. He's always talked about these issues in the same way his father talked about these issues. And it's had racial challenges and problems for using. He was sued for racism in the 70s along with his father, had to settle with the federal government. So you're seeing a person who really doesn't change, and he has lived a public life for so long. One of the most fascinating things I'll write about one day, if I ever have a chance to write a book, is to watch Trump watch TV. And I used to sit with him on the plane, because a lot of reporters, you got to understand, for so long I had an open playing field as a reporter, because all these other reporters were assuming, and they would not cover Trump. So I would be sometimes the only reporter on a trip covering Donald Trump. And I remember one time Trump got angry with me. Big surprise, right?
Does he have a nickname for you?
No, thank God. Thank God. But he called me out on Twitter a few weeks ago, just, you know, the usual BS, but it's no nickname. But long story short, I was with Trump in August of 15, flying back from Phoenix to New York. And I was supposed to do an hour-long interview with him. And I kept asking him on the plane. I said, "We got to do this interview. This is my job." And, "Oh, I'll do it in a few minutes." So we're about 20 minutes out from LaGuardia. And he finally calls me to come up and talk to him. And he does not like the questions I'm asking. He keeps turning to the TV, talking about himself on TV, cursing at me, yelling. And then he says to me, "Are you," and he uses the real word, "are you effing done?" And I said, yeah, I guess I'm done. 7 minutes in. Hmm. And he's in a bad mood, and he doesn't like the press coverage of his immigration rally. It was one of his first rallies in Arizona on about the wall and immigration. And so I land, and I call my editors, and I'm nervous. I'm going to lose my job or something. I got 7 minutes. I just spent 24 hours with this guy and 7 minutes of material. And my editor said, it's all right. Don't worry about it. So I go back to the hotel, and I listen to the tape, and it's just Trump cursing and yelling at me. And I just type it up, Costa Trump, Costa Trump. And I send it to my editors, and they go, this is gold.
You're in.
And
right?
They published it as listening to Donald Trump curse and yell as he flies across the United States. And this is August 2015. It becomes the most well-read story at the Washington Post, just the transcript of the seven-minute conversation. And it ends with, are you effing done? And it was the first time a transcript had been published with a Trump interview like this. And that became the norm in American political journalism, to publish the whole transcript of Trump, because it really reveals who he is. But I used to watch him watch TV on the plane, and you understand, at his core, he is someone who doesn't want to spend money. He used to watch the news, and he would say to himself, by himself, without advisors around him, how can I dive into that news cycle? Which for him meant not spending money. He didn't want to spend money in ads. So he'd figure out whatever was at the top of the news, he'd want to go where the cable news producers were going, and he would tweet something about it or use it in his speech. And he really saw up close then how he was able to win the nomination, how he's able to be president, which is to be saturating the media constantly with his own messaging. And he gets to the forefront of everything, to the A1 story, by just always jumping into the news. And almost no other politician I covered to this day has adapted. Buttigieg has been pretty media friendly and jumping into that fray, but no other politician really has adapted to Trump's style, which is making sure whenever news breaks, you're there, you're part of the news, and you define the story.
He has such an interesting relationship with reporters, and I think vice versa, because as you just described, he feeds off the kind of attention that he gets from all that press coverage. And at the same time, he talks about the media as the enemy of the people. How do you reconcile those two, and how dangerous do you think that is?
It's very dangerous, because institutional trust in the media is eroding every day. That's why WHYY is so important, PBS is so important. We need to have a universal set of facts. I mean, I wrote a front page story for the Post this week about the latest Republican talking points. They're creating this idea of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election as a way of not explaining President Trump's conduct and behavior. And that is not backed up by any facts. U.S. officials in this impeachment inquiry, who are nonpartisan, have testified repeatedly that did Ukrainian officials in 2016 have opinions about U.S. elections? Of course they did, as world leaders across the world did. But they did not interfere in the same way Russians interfered in the 2016 election. Yet Republicans have taken this talking point and made it the center of their cause as they defend President Trump.
That's journalist Robert Costa. I spoke with him this past weekend at a WHYY donor event. We'll talk more after the short break about Ukraine, Pelosi, and why Pennsylvania will be critical in the 2020 election. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're playing an interview I did with Washington Post national reporter Robert Costa, who's also the moderator for Washington Week on PBS Channel 12. We left off talking about the challenges reporters face covering President Trump.
I was Googling the Washington Post, and your paper tracks the president's misleading claims.
His
I forget
lies,
exactly
sure.
What the euphemism is.
Most lies. I
mean. This was as of October 14th, 13,435 false or misleading claims. As a reporter, how much attention should be given to the president himself, to his tweets, to the things that he says that are not true?
Look, we don't cover his rallies. People criticize the press, they say that he got too much coverage. The Washington Post, from day one of his campaign, was fact-checking him every other paragraph. He said something, we fact-checked it. And I stand by the Washington Post coverage. Sometimes I believe cable news covered Trump rallies too much.
Right.
But this idea that Trump was covered too much, I think is absurd. As someone who covered him for a long time, he wasn't covered enough. that this idea that he couldn't win made the press only wake up to him in many quarters in October of 2016. The studies about his conduct with women, his businesses, race, all should have happened way before the fall of 2016. And that's why I say now to my colleagues in the media, you don't think Buttigieg or Andrew Yang, these people could start rising, mm-hmm. whether it's this election or another election, they all deserve accountability. And President Trump needed more accountability in 2016. Less rally coverage, but more journalism.
But it's interesting that you have this relationship, and I'm not sure if that's exactly the right word, but a relationship with Bernie Sanders and with President Trump. But there must be something about their supporters that you saw that perhaps other people didn't see.
I appreciate you saying that. I think I saw something pretty obvious, but you all have picked up on it. But it's really driven my reporting for the last decade. The most important thing politically in the last 10 to 15 years is the 08-09 recession. And when I grew up with in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, soccer fields, Clinton politics, Bush politics, that became undermined by the economic recession of 08-09. And because I was covering the fringe of the right, I saw it up close in a way others didn't, in vivid ways, day in, day out, while you were working normal jobs. I was tracking the undercurrents of the Republican Party. And I saw creepy nationalism, populism. I saw suburban voters, rural voters being radicalized on both sides. Democrats who are Clinton types moving over to be Democratic socialists, frustrated with the global economy, the opioid epidemic. I saw Republicans who were Bush Republicans, country clubbers, becoming Trump nationalists. And that is all because of the fracturing from this global economic recession, where people who are a baby boom generation feel like they didn't save enough, or they're not in a safe position, or the kids don't have the same promise that they have. And we're still dealing with that reckoning right now. And it's the core of what I do as a reporter, is how both parties are navigating all these changes in American life. And it is so critical to understand that, I think, is the onus of it all. It's people want to think Trump, it's all about Trump. But I was just over in Europe in September, and you see nationalism sweeping Europe. They're dealing with the same issues. I was in London. When you talk to people over there about Brexit and Boris, it's the same kind of complaints I heard in this room over cocktails about how does this happen? Well, it's happening, and it's happening everywhere. And I really think Bernie and Trump are similar because that's why I don't write off Warren as a candidate at all. People say, oh, she's fading. Maybe she mishandled Medicare for All in the sense that she's not owning it and she's seen her poll numbers slip. But at the end of the day, Senator Warren is exactly what President Trump is and Bernie Sanders is in one key respect. She's an economic populist. President Trump used to tell me, I'm going to take all this anxiety and fear about the global economy, and his villain, his target, his answer was immigration. Immigrants were to blame. Senator Warren is taking that same anxiety and fear, and she's saying it's not the immigrant, it's the corporation, it's the wealthy. And that's it's the same argument, economic populism, against a different target.
I'm curious about what you make of Rudy Giuliani.
How many butt dials have I gotten from him?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was...
Sometimes I see it and I go,
America's mayor, of course, as we know from, and certainly from 2001, he was a
U.S.
attorney.
You know, I get emails all the time, don't call him Mayor Giuliani.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, people
say. What does he want to be?
Well, no, readers will always say to me, don't call him Mayor Giuliani. You know,
but what do you make of,
so much detestment for Giuliani.
Well, I'm not.
He's over in Ukraine right now, as we
know. He is over in Ukraine, digging
up dirt. Making a documentary.
So what do you make of, he is the president's lawyer. He is trading in these conspiracy theories. He is he's over there while the House is considering impeachment. What do you make of what he's doing?
Well, I mean, he's been a big source of mine for a long time. Someone I would talk to for the Post, you have to talk to the president's lawyer during the Mueller thing. And so I got the assignment, just like I got the plum assignment of covering Trump when no one wanted to. People say, you be the Giuliani contact. So all of Mueller, I used to stake out Robert Mueller's office in Southwest and cover all the witnesses. I was part of the Post coverage of Mueller for 2 years. And Giuliani, I was the Giuliani guy. We went to Giuliani if we needed comment from the Trump lawyer. My biggest regret, I was with Woodward last night at dinner, and he's been my mentor and friend at the Post.
Woodward.
But my biggest regret reporting-wise over the last year, and I can't stand it, keeps me up at night, as I used to go, because I've known Giuliani, I've interviewed him 100 times. I used to go see him at times at the Trump Hotel in Washington, and I would see him with Igor Fruman Lev Parnas. But because, you know, my motto is assume nothing, I assume this was just a kind of a, they were playing games and all this. How I didn't just say, I'm dropping everything and going to cover Lev and Igor would have been the story of a century. But I did get to see the Ukrainian pressure campaign up close. Have I told you this? No.
No, no, go
so,
for it.
So sometimes I feel like Forrest Gump the way I see history up close. So I don't take vacation. My parents who live in Yardley think I'm going to have a breakdown. I never take vacation. I work so much. So I said, I'm going to do the closest thing I can to taking vacation. I'm going to go cover Vice President Pence. So, no joke. I look at my itinerary given to me by the Pence people, and the first meeting is in the Marriott in Warsaw with the Ukrainian president, who's also part of the ceremony. He's going to have a one-on-one with Vice President Pence, and his name's Volodymyr Zelensky. Mm. So I'm pulled into this room, and I assume that the military aid that I'd read about, this $250 million, this is September 1st of 2019, military aid was going to be announced. So I say to the Pence people, is that the story? They say, just go cover the meeting. I said, okay, sure. So I go to the meeting. Volodymyr Zelensky just keeps tapping his foot. And then when I yell out, is this aid going to be given? Is that the point of this meeting? No response is given. And I'm shoved out of the room. And so I said, what is going on? I'm just trying to get the story. And I say, what's the story here? Is there aid? Oh, they just had a bilateral meeting. Wow. So I go up to Pence with a couple other reporters the next day. I said, what was that meeting about with Zelensky? Did you discuss Vice President Biden? And Vice President Pence goes, did not discuss at all Vice President Biden. Then we said, what did you discuss? We discussed corruption in Ukraine. And I thought, what does that even mean, corruption in Ukraine? I mean, we know there's corruption, but why would you discuss corruption and this aid was still not given out? There was no announcement. So that's September 1st. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, Marty, the whistleblower complaint. Then a week later, we find out it's actually about Ukraine. And now it's December. Here we are on the brink of history, the impeachment of a president.
Well, let's talk about Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker. She announced that the House would begin drafting articles of impeachment. This is historic. It's sobering, as she said, as well. And she was reluctant. What's interesting about her is that she was not leading the charge on this, but something changed her mind. What do you think it was?
Well, I know it was the decision by moderate Democrats in the House and the freshman members who were elected from places like the Philly suburbs in 2018, after this started to build up as a story on Ukraine, they finally went to the speaker and said, it's time for impeachment. And she had been waiting and waiting. And Speaker Pelosi is one of the most impressive people I cover in politics. But when you read any biography of Pelosi, or you talk to her, you understand she has been a leader on liberal ideology her whole career. Climate change, women's issues, voting rights. She has been there on health care, worked with President Obama. But as much as she is a liberal through and through, she is a political tactician, and she spent her childhood counting votes for her father in the precincts of Baltimore. And that's the mentality she brings to the Speaker's office. And she wants to make sure this moves forward quickly, because she does not, talking to her allies, they tell me, she doesn't want it to overwhelm the presidential race once it starts in earnest in January and February of next year, very soon. At the same time, she's trying to project seriousness about the entire endeavor. That's why she had Adam Schiff take over at the House Intelligence Committee to make sure Schiff, her ally from California, was in control. And with all respect to Chairman Nadler of Judiciary, she gave him an opportunity to have a limited hearing, but that limited hearing was about underscoring the constitutionality in her eyes of what the Democrats are doing, because she knows that many of her members who won in 2018 come from these swing districts, and they're getting pummeled right now from the Trump campaign and Republicans for not focusing enough on trade and USMCA and jobs, and they don't want to see the Democratic Party tarred as too focused on impeachment. And you look at the latest jobs numbers on Friday, President Trump, now this could change, but with the Dow at 28,000, and this S&P at 3,000, and the jobs numbers where they are, manufacturing is weak, to be sure, but the jobs numbers are pretty strong. Democrats are nervous in the House, but they also feel a duty that to move forward on impeachment. When I pull them aside, they say they really do feel a duty that President Trump abused power in their view, and they need to call him to account. So she's trying to manage all of that at once.
Well, I think James Risen and others saw she's a formidable woman. You do not cross Nancy Pelosi. But it's so interesting to look at her and compare her to John Boehner or Paul Ryan, who were essentially driven out of office by their sort of right-wing flank of their party. She's been able to hold people together, including people on the left.
She has, and she's going to face some challenges in 2020, and she's trying to make sure the party doesn't get defined as Medicare for all. She's been holding back from embracing that wing of the Democratic Party. She knows her sweet spot in 2018 was the suburbs, and she wants to do that again. She's an effective tactician. She's pretty tough to deal with. She's respectful to reporters, but if you're a member of the House, she watches everything you do.
Wow.
And if you know that famous line, if you come at the king, you best not miss. You come at the queen, you best not miss.
I've interviewed a number of reporters, yourself included, talking about what it's like to cover the Republican Party and the president. And oftentimes they will say, off the record, members of the Republican Party, elected members, have real problems with the president, but publicly there is no daylight or very little daylight between most elected Republicans in Congress, House and Senate, and the president. How do you understand, are they afraid of him?
They're afraid of their voters. They're not afraid of him. When I was talking about the radicalization of the Republican Party, that's something these members see up close. They believe that when Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan lost in 2012, running as free trade Republicans, pro-corporate Republicans, that they couldn't win Wisconsin. They couldn't win Pennsylvania. That they didn't see a path for the Republican Party, a future for the Republican Party as a free trade, conservative, traditional party. And they didn't have an answer for that. They didn't have a solution. And they didn't want to go in the Trump direction of protectionism on trade and hardline positions on immigration and racially charged, to say the least, on certain policies. But they didn't have any answer. And so they saw their voters rally around President Trump's brand of politics. And there's an acceptance in the Republican Party that this is the way it's going to be. Hmm. This is the way it may have to be, because voters just don't respond anymore to establishment conservative politics. And they see the rise of Bernie Sanders and the rise of Trump as similar effects. And they're dealing with that. And they see Trump as someone they can have a deal with. The U.S. Senate used to be a great legislative body. Now it is a body that mostly spends its time confirming conservative judges. And Mitch McConnell will be remembered as a historic figure because he has confirmed and overhauled the Fed judiciary in an extraordinary way. And that's what they've done. They've gotten a tax cut, they've overhauled the Fed judiciary, and they have their voters with this guy, President Trump. And what they also realize, and I noticed this as a reporter, is this country is rough and tumble. This idea that people are appalled by President Trump's conduct, I'm continually reminded as I travel around the country that people are not paying attention to President Trump's conduct in the same way people in the media are often paying attention to his conduct. And I have to remember that as a reporter, that what Washington cares about is not necessarily what the rest of the country cares about. And that when I'm out there, people are talking about where is the USMCA, where is the trade deal with China, and the latest development on Rudy Giuliani just isn't breaking through.
Yeah.
And part of that's the collapse of local media, unfortunately. Thank God WHYY is doing well and providing such a valuable resource. But a lot of places around the country, I visit state capitals, there's no one there covering anything.
We are in Philadelphia. We're in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was a significant battleground state in the last presidential election. I assume it will be in 2020.
There will. President Trump's going to be in Hershey on Tuesday.
On Tuesday. And is it the Philly suburbs? Is that the sort of make or break place for whoever the candidates are?
Well, the Democrats have to turn out Philadelphia. I mean, Secretary Clinton's numbers were not where they needed to be in Philadelphia. And the other thing the Democrats have to contend with in 2020 is that President Trump's ability to rally independent and non-active voters in western Pennsylvania was historic. And I remember I went across Pennsylvania, because I love Pennsylvania so much. The Washington Post allowed me to do this. The last week of the campaign in 2016, I started at the western border of Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh, and I drove straight across on the turnpike, stopping at different towns, all the way across Pennsylvania, all the way to the Delaware-New Jersey border to Trenton. And I knew after I did that story in the last week that Trump would win. No one believed me in the newsroom, it seemed. I was still late at night saying we have to get ready to write about Trump. Because what I wrote in that story is that we missed it until the last week. driving across Western Pennsylvania, I've never seen anything like it in my life as a reporter. The amount of signs on barns, on homes, Trump, Trump, Trump. And I would go up to voters in these small towns, in suburban and exurban towns, and I would say to them, who are you voting for? And the first answer they'd almost always give is, I hate them both. I hate them both. Third or fourth question in, I hate them both. Fifth or sixth question in, who are you voting for? Trump, 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 Trump. And I said, oh boy.
Wow.
I called my editor. I said, they're lying to me. They may be lying to the pollsters. And I said to a lot of these voters, are you telling anyone about this? No. What about your spouse, your significant other, your friends? No. No communication. That's part of the problem in this country. There's no civic dialogue. People are afraid because of social stigma to say they're a Bernie Democrat, that they're a socialist now. They're afraid to say they're a nationalist now. So no one even communicates. People are in these silos. And so people didn't tell the pollsters. They didn't tell their friends. Yet it was everywhere in Western Pennsylvania that these people wanted radical change. They didn't just want Trump. They wanted radical change. And Trump was radical change. And Democrats have to contend with that. They're in a strong position. You look at the suburbs in 18 and the most recent elections in 19. Democrats are making significant gains in the suburbs of Philadelphia. But that doesn't mean it's going to totally outweigh what happens in the western part of the state. So as much as Democrats feel like Pennsylvania is almost certainly back in their fold in 2020, the polls show it's leaning in that direction, we know the polls can be wrong.
Well, to be continued.
Yeah. I just want to say, WHYY, thank you so much. Marty Moskowitz has been a real
Costa.
Friend.
And
thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That was Robert Costa, national reporter for The Washington Post and moderator for PBS's Washington Week that airs on TV 12. We spoke Saturday night at a special event for WHYY donors. Engineers for this interview, Joyce Lieberman and Diana Martinez. After this short break, a different election in another country, the choices that British voters face this Thursday. Our guest is George Parker from the Financial Times. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moskowitz, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Voters in Britain will go to the polls on Thursday to decide what kind of country they want to be. Prime Minister Boris Johnson, leader of the Conservative Party, has campaigned on a hard and quick Brexit, getting out of the EU in 2020. Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party, says that socialism is the answer to the country's problems. Here's a clip from a recent debate moderated by Nick Robinson.
Socialism or capitalism? Jeremy Corbyn.
Socialism carried out in a democratic way in this country, in Scandinavia and other places, has raised the living standards of the very poorest. And it was the post-war Labour government that did massively to improve the living standards of the poorest working class communities in this country. And our Labour government will do the same again.
And I would say that it is one nation conservatism, which understands the vital importance of a dynamic market economy as the only way in which you can pay for fantastic public services and for giving and for looking after the poorest and neediest in our society.
Voters in Britain won't be casting their ballots for either of these two candidates. Rather, they will choose their local representative to the House of Commons, and the leader of the party with the most seats forms a new government. At least that is how it is supposed to work. Joining us from the BBC is George Parker. He's political editor for the Financial Times, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
A pleasure.
What's the mood in your country these days?
I would say a bit depressed, and we have an election where neither of the two principal candidates standing to be Prime Minister, Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn, who you just heard there, seem to me to be attracting a whole lot of enthusiasm for the from the British public. And people often say this has become almost an unpopularity contest, you know, the choices between the leader who you dislike least. But certainly, you know, it's the campaign's been going on for 5 weeks. It's a winter election. We don't normally have those. The weather's pretty grim. And people are preparing to go to vote on Thursday, with the polls suggesting at least that Boris Johnson's heading for a victory.
Now, my understanding, this is the fourth national election in 4 years. Is there kind of ennui about going to the polls again?
I think that's definitely the case. Going to the polls in this time of year as well, just coming up to Christmas, is obviously made people slightly more depressed about the whole thing. But it's important to say that there's seldom been an election where there's been more at stake for the country, which is one of the reasons why, although the campaign itself has been rather dispiriting, you find that lots of people are quite engaged in the issues. And certainly there's a big choice here between, as you were hearing at the top of the item there, between Boris Johnson, who's offering a sort of hard Brexit very quickly, and Jeremy Corbyn, who's offering the possibility of Britain staying in the EU through a second referendum, and then a very sort of hard dose of old-school socialism. Some people would say back to the 1970s socialism. So it's a real choice for the public.
And is the choice, is it, when you sort of boil it down, is it staying, leaving the EU or staying in the EU? Is that sort of what is really galvanizing whatever enthusiasm there is there for voters?
Yeah, I think so. Brexit is the defining issue of this election, and it's the thing that's most at stake. So to recap, Britain voted to leave the European Union in 2016, so over 3 years ago. And since then, we've been arguing about how we should leave and when we should leave and on what terms. And Boris Johnson is basically saying, if you vote for me, we'll complete the exit process and Britain will be out of the EU in January. And then we'll start the whole process of trying to renegotiate a trade deal with the EU. Whereas on the other hand, Jeremy Corbyn saying if you vote Labour and we get a Labour government or a minority government supported by other parties, we'll have a second referendum where people can choose whether they made the right decision in the first place or not, or whether they want to reverse it. But Brexit, just to finally say, is the thing that's completely changed British politics. In the old days, as with the United States, politics seemed to be done based very much on class issues, partly on race as well, actually, to be fair. But Brexit is really the issue that people define themselves by now, whether they voted Remain or Leave. It's a mindset. It's a way of thinking.
Is it dividing the country, though?
Completely. I mean, the country voted 52-48 to leave the EU. The polls pretty much say that still exists. And the thing about Brexit, it's not just about whether Britain should be a member of this international club or not. It's really about an outlook on life and the economy. And people who were voting against Brexit for staying in the EU were people who generally tended to benefit from the global economy and being connected and from Britain being open with lots of cheap labour coming in from abroad. And the people who voted to leave the EU are people who felt they've been left behind by and large, people who felt that the international economic system wasn't working for them, looking for someone to blame. And, you know, a remote European Union based in Brussels was obviously quite a convenient target to kick.
Is there a generational divide in Britain?
Absolutely a generational divide. You know, if you look at the people who voted for Brexit, they tended to be much older. Something like 75% of people aged over 75 voted to leave the European Union.
Wow.
And you could almost reverse that figure for people under 25. So young people tend to be more open. They travel widely in Europe. They have friends who live and work in other European countries. And it has split the country on those lines, sort of on an age level as well.
Do you think Boris is going to win?
It feels like that at the moment. So I think the real mood of the country is summarised by Boris Johnson's Conservative Party's election slogan, which is "Get Brexit Done." Now, there are a lot of people who voted to stay in the European Union who now think, actually, this has gone on for long enough. And actually, do we really want to have another referendum and another year of this bitter division and an uncertain result? Or should we just draw a line under this whole unhappy episode and leave? And so Boris Johnson seems to me to have captured the mood of the country with "Get Brexit Done." But I don't think it's in the bag. You know, you could be talking about on Thursday in the election, you know, quite a big Conservative majority. That's what the polls are suggesting. But it wouldn't take a very big swing back at the last minute to Labour and Jeremy Corbyn to deprive Boris Johnson of that majority. And if that happened, we'd be into a very messy situation indeed, where Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party would be the biggest party, but there'd be a whole load of other parties that would be there needed to put him into number 10, including Scottish National Party, who want a second referendum on Scottish independence. So if Jeremy...
And we thought we had problems, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, So it's not just the future of Britain's place in right. Europe, it's the future of the United Kingdom itself, which is at stake in this election.
Well, we know that Boris Johnson is a colorful candidate. He's more than that. But there's this crazy quote that I read from him. Cupid's darts will fly once we get Brexit done. I guess the idea that Brexit is some kind of aphrodisiac for supporters.
Yeah, well, he made a similar claim around the time of the 2012 London Olympic Games when he was mayor of London, and he claimed at the time that everyone was so delighted about the Olympic Games that there'd be a baby boom short of 9 months afterwards, and he claims that the evidence suggests that was true. So now he's suggesting there'll be a Brexit baby boom, and we'll wait and see. It's one of the many extraordinary things Boris Johnson said in this campaign, to be honest.
You wrote recently, I think it was yesterday, Johnson does not like losing, and you go on from there. And you also talk about how he's been, I guess, cleaned up in a certain kind of way. Is this a new kind of Boris Johnson?
Yeah, what we've seen is Boris Johnson on a very tight leash during this election campaign. I mean, Boris Johnson is the kind of politician you'll be familiar with in the States. He's friends with Donald Trump. There are certain elements of the Donald Trump style of campaigning which you would expect from him. But in this campaign, he's been very disciplined. He has tried to generally cut back on the jokes. He's got a slightly smarter haircut. He's wearing slightly less baggy suits. He's wearing slightly more expensive ties. But he's basically run a very safety first, controlled campaign. And I think what his campaign advisors are trying to do is contrast him as someone who people might think as being prime ministerial against Jeremy Corbyn, who all the polls suggest people don't find prime ministerial at all.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's George Parker. He's political editor for the Financial Times, getting us up to speed on a vote this Thursday in Britain. And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also call us, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We talk a lot about politics in this country. We thought we would spend a moment during this hour of Radio Times talking about politics across the pond. So help us understand, I guess, the support for Jeremy Corbyn, but also why he is so controversial and in many ways why he is so unliked.
Well, the opinion poll suggests he's the least popular opposition leader in polling history. He's got a satisfaction rating of something like minus 40. And this is quite a contrast to how he was perceived 2 years ago when he recently became Labour leader. And I think probably the best analogy for your listeners is that Jeremy Corbyn is like a British version of Bernie Sanders. He's in his 70s. He's the lifelong socialist. And I think a lot of people back in 2017, the last time we had an election in this country, found him a breath of fresh air, someone who seemed to have principles, who spoke his mind, who seemed to be connecting with young people by promising a lot of extra public spending, state interference or involvement in the economy. But since then, things have gone slightly wrong for Jeremy Corbyn. The first thing is that his supporters have slowly cottoned on to the fact that actually Jeremy Corbyn is not actually in favour of Britain staying in the European Union, which is, as we were talking about earlier, lots of young people think Britain's future is in Europe. Jeremy Corbyn, the only time previously that we had a vote on European Union membership, back in 1975, Jeremy Corbyn voted to leave. And some people still think that's privately his view. So people have sort of got onto that a bit. And the second thing is that his party has been plunged into a really acrimonious row about anti-Semitism, that some of his supporters on the left of British politics have been caught involved in anti-Semitic language, threats against Jewish Labour MPs. And it's become a real running sore, which people feel that Jeremy Corbyn hasn't done enough to deal with.
Has he dealt with it at all?
Well, he says he has, and he says he's brought in new disciplinary procedures and all the rest of it. But a number of Labour Jewish MPs have left the party and they feel they've been threatened. They've suffered a lot of abuse online and also in person. And so there's a feeling that he hasn't dealt with it. And it's a stain on the left of British politics, and probably some would say on the far left of Labour politics, where it seems to be a sort of a toxic brew of, criticism of the state of Israel and the way it's treated Palestine, but wrapped in with a dislike of American-style capitalism and, by extension, the traditional trope of the Jewish involvement in high finance and banking and all the rest of it. And it seems to have got mixed up into a stew where it's sort of boiled over into pretty ugly anti-Semitic stuff, which, as I said, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't seem to have dealt with very effectively.
What's a moderate voter in Britain then supposed to do? Or do, what? First of all, are there moderate voters, and what do they want? And does anyone represent their perspective?
Well, this is one of the massive frustrations of this election, that the British people, I don't think, have changed very much. I think the British people are still the kind of people you'd probably imagine us to be, sort of, in America, sort of fairly sensible, pragmatic, moderate people. And yet we've been plunged into this sort of terrible national psychodrama by this question of Brexit. But I think, you know, the centre of ground of British politics is there to be colonised. And it's one of the reasons why people are so dispirited by this election, that you've got the Conservative Party going off to sort of down quite a right-wing path and down the route of Brexit, and then the Labour Party going off quite a long way to the left. And there's this huge space in the middle, which people keep saying needs to be occupied by a third party. And there is a third centrist party called the Liberal Democrats, but their campaign, frankly, hasn't really taken off in this election. And so what you're finding is people are actually being forced to choose to vote for the candidate they think will stop the guy they really hate getting into Downing Street. So it's a really
complicated.
It's complicated, and it's one of the reasons why people are so dispirited by this whole contest.
I'm curious about Nigel Farage's party. It's called the Brexit Party. Is there support for his party in Britain?
Well, he used to run a party called UKIP, the UK Independence Party, right, which campaigned for Brexit, and they were extremely successful as a sort of pressure group, really, to force the then Conservative Prime Minister to have the referendum on Brexit, and then, of course, they won it. So they were very successful. Nigel Farage, you could argue, has been one of the most effective British politicians since the Second World War in terms of getting what he wants and taking Britain out of the European Union. But now that we've voted to leave the European Union, and Boris Johnson has adopted the mantle of the Brexit Party by promising to finally complete the job of taking us out of the European Union, the Brexit Party, which is the spin-off of UKIP that Nigel Farage now leads, has become a bit of a sorry spectacle in this election that doesn't really seem to have a point. And as a result, it's not standing in half the seats in this election. And Nigel Farage has been a rather peripheral figure and looking slightly forlorn.
I'm curious, this is just a scenario, but let's assume that Boris Johnson wins and he's able to put together a government and the Get Brexit Done policy is put into effect. What impact would that have on Britain?
Well, Boris Johnson, this slogan, Get Brexit Done, has been very effective in this campaign, but I suspect its shallowness will be exposed if he wins the election, because leaving the European Union in January is only the first part of this process. The much more difficult part, in my view, is to negotiate a new trade and security relationship with the European Union, when, frankly, Britain will be negotiating from a position of weakness, because we'll be a smallish country compared with a very large trading bloc on our doorstep. And Boris Johnson says he wants to get this new trading relationship negotiated within a year, which most people think is a highly unlikely scenario. So I think that's the first thing to say. Then Boris Johnson says that he wants to make Britain a global player and a champion of free trade. And one of the first things he says he wants to do is to negotiate a trade deal with the United States. Now, whether that is going to be quite as easy as Boris Johnson and Donald Trump have been suggesting up until now is a very moot point, because as we've seen, the idea that Donald Trump is some sort of champion of global free trade and is going to cut his friend Boris Johnson a great trade deal in a few months, I think it's slightly fanciful as well. So I think, you know, it's going to take a bit of time for Britain to get back on its feet, I think. But, you know, you could argue that Boris Johnson is the kind of person who might at least have the chutzpah to do it, because he does look like an optimistic, you know, sort of a leader. He models himself a bit on Winston Churchill. So in these slightly difficult times for our country, despite the fact that Boris Johnson has a problem with trust and lots of people find him very depressing because of his Brexit stance, you could actually imagine him being someone who could at least try to lift the spirits of a slightly jaded country at the moment.
Well, we will be watching what's happening in your country, George Parker. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you, George.
Pleasure.
You're very welcome. And he's political editor for the Financial Times, and he joined us from the studios of the BBC. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and tell us what you think of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.